Windsor Farms, an old Richmond neighborhood with English street names and stately Georgian and Tudor homes that some would call mansions. Lights were on in windows I passed, and beyond glass I could see fine furniture and chandeliers, and people moving or watching TV. No one seemed to close their curtains in this city, except me. Leaves had begun to fall. It was cool and overcast, and when I pulled into my driveway, smoke was drifting from the chimney. My niece's ancient green Suburban parked in front. "Lucy!" I called out as I shut the door and turned off the alarm. "I'm in here," she replied from the end of the house where she always stayed. As I headed for my office to deposit my briefcase and the pile I had brought home to work on tonight, she emerged from her bedroom, pulling a bright orange UVA sweatshirt over her head. "Hi!" Smiling, she gave me a hug, and there was very little that was soft about her. Holding her at arm's length, I took a good look at her, just like I always did. "Uh-oh," she playfully said. "Inspection time." She held out her arms and turned around, as if about to be searched. "Smarty," I said. In truth, I would have preferred it had she weighed a little more, but she was keenly pretty and healthy, with auburn hair that was short but softly styled. After all this time, I still couldn't look at her without envisioning a precocious, obnoxious 10-year-old who had no one, really, but me. "You pass," I said. "Sorry I'm so late." "Tell me again what it was you were doing," I asked, for she had called earlier in the day to say she couldn't get here until dinner. "An assistant attorney general decided to drop in with an entourage. As usual, they wanted HRT to put on a show." We headed to the kitchen. "I trotted out Toto and Tin Man," she added. They were robots. "Used fiber optics, virtual reality. The usual things, except it's pretty cool. We parachuted them out of a Huey, and I maneuvered them to burn through a metal door with lasers." "No stunts with the helicopters, I hope," I said. "The guys did that. I did my shit from the ground." She wasn't happy about it. The problem was, Lucy wanted to do stunts with helicopters. There were 50 agents on the HRT. She was the only woman and had a tendency to overreact when they wouldn't let her do dangerous things that, in my opinion, she had no business doing anyway. Of course, I wasn't the most objective judge. "It suits me fine if you stick with robots," I said, and we were in the kitchen now. "Something smells good. What did you fix your tired old aunt to eat?" "Fresh spinach, sautéed in a little garlic and olive oil, and fillets that I'm going to throw on the grill. This is my one day a week to eat beef, so tough luck if it's not yours. I even sprung for a bottle of really nice wine, something Janet and I discovered." "Since when can FBI agents afford nice wine?" "Hey," she said. "I don't do too bad. Besides, I'm too damn busy to spend money." Certainly, she didn't spend it on clothes. Whenever I saw her, she was either in khaki fatigues or sweats. Now and then she wore jeans and a funky jacket or blazer, and made fun of my offers of hand-me-downs. She wouldn't wear my lawyerly suits and blouses with high collars, and frankly, my figure was fuller than her firm athletic one. Probably nothing in my closet would fit. The moon was huge and low in a cloudy, dark sky. We put on jackets and sat out on the deck drinking wine while Lucy cooked. She had started baked potatoes first, and they were taking a while, so we talked. Over recent years, our relationship had become less mother-daughter as we evolved into colleagues and friends. The transition wasn't an easy one, for often she taught me and even worked on some of my cases. I felt oddly lost, no longer certain of my role and power in her life. "Wesley wants me to track this AOL thing," she was saying. "Sussex definitely wants Caskew's help." "Do you know Percy Ring?" I asked, as I thought of what he had said in my office, infuriated again. "He was in one of my classes and was obnoxious. Wouldn't shut up." She reached for the bottle of wine. "What a peacock." She began filling our glasses. Raising the hood of the grill, she poked potatoes with a fork. "I believe we're ready," she said, pleased. Moments later, she was emerging from the house, carrying the fillets. They sizzled as she placed them on the grill. "Somehow he figured out you're my aunt." She was talking about Ring again. "Not that it's a secret. And he asked me about it after class once. You know, if you tutored me, helped me out with my cases, like I couldn't possibly do what I'm doing on my own, that sort of thing. I just think he picks on me because I'm a new agent and a woman." "That may be the biggest miscalculation he's ever made in his life," I said. "And he wanted to know if I was married." Her eyes were shadowed as porch light shone on one side of her face. "I worry about what his interest really is," I commented. She glanced at me as she cooked. "The usual." She shrugged it off, for she was surrounded by men and paid no attention to their comments or their stares. "Lucy, he made a reference to you in my office today," I said. "A veiled reference."
"To what?"
"Your status. Your roommate." No matter how often or delicately we talked about this, she always got frustrated and impatient. "Whether it's true or not," she said, and the sizzling of the grill seemed to match her tone, "there would still be rumors because I'm an agent. It's ridiculous. I know women married with kids, and the guys think all of them are gay, too, just because they're cops, agents, troopers, Secret Service. Some people even think it about you. For the same reason. Because of your position, your power." "This isn't about accusations," I reminded her gently. "This is about whether someone could hurt you. Ring is very smooth. He comes across as credible. I expect he resents that you're FBI, HRT, and he's not." "I think he's already demonstrated that." Her voice was hard. "I just hope the jerk doesn't keep asking you out."
"Oh, he already is. At least half a dozen times."
She sat down. "He even asked Janet out, if you can believe that," she laughed. "Talk about not getting it." "The problem is, I think he does get it," I said ominously. "It's like he's building a case against you, gathering evidence."
"Well, gather away."
She abruptly ended our discussion. "So, tell me what else went on today." I told her what I had learned at the labs, and we talked about fibers embedded in bone and Koss's analysis of them as we carried steaks and wine inside. We sat at the kitchen table with a candle lit, digesting information few people would serve with food.
"A cheap motel curtain could have a backing like that," Lucy said.
"That or something like a drop cloth, because of the paint-like substance," I replied. "The spinach is wonderful. Where did you get it?"
"You crops."
"I'd give anything to have a store like that in my neighborhood." "So, this person wrapped the victim in a drop cloth and then dismembered her through it?" she asked as she cut her meat.
"That's certainly the way it's looking."
"What does Wesley say?" She met my eyes. "I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet." This wasn't quite true.
I hadn't even called.
For a moment, Lucy was silent. She got up and brought a bottle of Evian to the table.
So how long do you plan to run from him?
I pretended not to hear her, in hopes she wouldn't start in.
You know that's what you're doing. You're scared.
This is not something we should discuss, I said, especially when we're having such a pleasant evening. She reached for her wine.
It's very good, by the way, I said. I like Pinot Noir because it's light, not heavy like a Merlot. I'm not in the mood for anything heavy right now. So, you made a good choice.
She stabbed another bite of steak, getting my point.
Tell me how things are going with Janet, I went on. Mostly doing white-collar crime in D.C.? Or is she getting to spend more time at ERF these days?
Lucy stared out the window at the moon as she slowly swirled wine in her glass.
I should get started on your computer.
While I cleaned up, she disappeared into my office. I didn't disturb her for a very long time, if for no other reason than I knew she was put out with me. She wanted complete openness, and I had never been good at that, not with anyone. I felt bad, as if I had let down everyone I loved. For a while, I sat at the kitchen desk, talking to Marino on the phone, and I called to catch up with my mother. I put on a pot of decaffeinated coffee and carried two mugs down the hall. Lucy was busy at my keyboard, glasses on, a slight frown furrowing her young, smooth brow as she concentrated. I set her coffee down and looked over her head at what she was typing. It made no sense to me. It never did.
"How's it going?" I asked.
I could see my face reflected in the monitor as she struck the Enter key again, executing another Unix command.
"Good and not good,"
she replied with an impatient sigh. "The problem with applications like AOL is you can't track files unless you get into the original programming language. That's where I am now. And it's like following breadcrumbs through a universe with more layers than an onion." I pulled up a chair and sat next to her. "Lucy," I said, "how did someone send these photographs to me? Can you tell me, step by step?" She stopped what she was doing, slipping off her glasses and setting them on the desk. She rubbed her face in her hands and massaged her temples as if she had a headache.
"You got any Tylenol?" she asked.
"No acetaminophen with alcohol." I opened a drawer and got out a bottle of Motrin instead.
"For starters," she said, taking two. "This wouldn't have been easy if your screen name wasn't the same as your real one. K. Scarpetta."
"I made it easy deliberately for my colleagues to send me mail," I explained one more time.
"You made it easy for anyone to send you mail."
She looked accusingly at me.
"Have you gotten crank mail before?"
"I think this goes beyond crank mail.
Please answer my question."
"A few things. Nothing to worry about." I paused, then went on. "Generally, after a lot of publicity because of some big case, a sensational trial, whatever."
"You should change your username."
"No," I said. "Dead Doc might want to send me something else. I can't change it now."
"Oh, great."
She put her glasses back on.
"So now you want him to be a pen pal?"
"Lucy, please," I quietly said, and I was getting a headache too. "We both have a job to do." She was quiet for a moment. Then she apologized.
"I guess I'm just as overly protective of you as you've always been of me." I still am. I patted her knee. Okay. So he got my screen name from the AOL directory of subscribers, right? She nodded. Let's talk about your AOL profile. There's nothing in it but my professional title, my office phone number, and address, I said. I never entered personal details, such as marital status, date of birth, hobbies, etc. I have more sense than that. Have you checked out his profile? She asked. The one for Dead Doc. Frankly, it never occurred to me that he would have one, I said. Depressed, I thought of saw marks I couldn't tell apart, and felt I had made yet one more mistake this day. Oh, he's got one all right. Lucy was typing again. He wants you to know who he is. That's why he wrote it. She clicked to the member directory, and when she opened Dead Doc's profile, I couldn't believe what was before my eyes. I scanned keywords that could be searched by anyone interested in finding other users to whom they applied. Attorney, autopsy, chief medical examiner, Cornell, corpse, death, dismemberment, FBI, forensic, Georgetown, Italian, Johns Hopkins, judicial, killer, lawyer, medical, pathologist, physician, scuba, Virginia, woman. The list went on. The professional and personal information, the hobbies, all describing me. It's like Dead Doc saying he's you, Lucy said. I was dumbfounded and suddenly felt very cold. This is crazy. Lucy pushed back her chair and looked at me. He's got your profile. In cyberspace, on the World Wide Web, you're both the same person with two different screen names. We are not the same person. I can't believe you said that. I looked at her, shocked. The photographs are yours, and you sent them to yourself. It was easy. You simply scanned them into your computer. No big deal. You can get portable color scanners for $400 or $500. Attach the file to the message 10, which you send to K. Scarpetta, send to yourself, in other words. Lucy, I cut her off. For God's sake, that's enough. She was silent, her face without expression. This is outrageous. I can't believe what you're saying. I got up from the chair in disgust. If your fingerprints were on the murder weapon, she replied, wouldn't you want me to tell you? My fingerprints aren't on anything. Aunt Kay, I'm just making the point that someone out there is stalking you, impersonating you on the Internet. Of course you didn't do anything, but what I'm trying to impress upon you is every time someone does a search by subject because they need help from an expert like you, they're going to get Dead Doc's name, too. How could he have known all this information about me? I went on. It's not in my profile. I don't have anything in there about where I went to law school, medical school, that my heritage is Italian. Maybe from things written about you over the years. I suppose. I felt as if I were coming down with something. Would you like a nightcap? I'm very tired. But she was lost again in the dark space of the Unix environment, with its strange symbols and commands like CAT, colon Q, exclamation point, and VI. Aunt Kay, what's your password in AOL? She asked. The same one I use for everything else, I confessed, knowing she would be annoyed again. Shit! Don't tell me you're still using Sinbad! She looked up at me. My mother's rotten cat has never been mentioned in anything ever written about me. I defended myself. I watched as she typed the command, password, and entered Sinbad. Do you do password aging? She asked, as if everyone should know what that meant. I have no idea what you're talking about. Where you change your password at least once a month. No, I said. Who else knows your password? Rose knows it. And, of course, now you do, I said. There's no way Dead Doc could. There's always a way. He could use a Unix password encryption program to encrypt every word in a dictionary, then compare every encrypted word to your password. It wasn't that complicated, I said with conviction. I bet whoever did this doesn't know a thing about Unix. Lucy closed what she was doing and looked curiously at me, swiveling the chair around. Why do you say that? Because he could have washed the body first, so trace evidence didn't adhere to blood. He shouldn't have given us a photo of her hands. Now we may have her prints. I was leaning against the door frame, holding my aching head. He's not that smart. Maybe he doesn't think her prints will ever matter, she said, getting up. And by the way, she said as she walked by, almost any computer book's going to tell you it's stupid to choose a password that's the name of your significant other or your cat. Sinbad's not my cat. I wouldn't have a miserable Siamese that always gives me the fisheye and stalks me whenever I walk into my mother's house. Well, you must like him a little bit, or you wouldn't have wanted to think of him every time you log on to your computer, she said from down the hall. I don't like him in the least, I said. The next morning, the air was crisp and clean like a fall apple. Stars were out, traffic mostly truckers in the midst of long hauls. I turned off on 64 East, just beyond the state fairgrounds, and minutes later was prowling rows in short-term parking at the Richmond International Airport. I chose a space in S because I knew it would be easy for me to remember, and was reminded of my password again, of other obvious acts of carelessness caused by overload. As I was getting my bag out of the trunk, I heard footsteps behind me and instantly wheeled around. Don't shoot! Marino held up his hands. It was cool enough out that I could see his breath. I wish you'd whistle or something when you walk up on me in the dark, I said, slamming shut the trunk. Oh, and bad people don't whistle. Only good guys like me do. He grabbed my suitcase. You want me to get that, too? He reached for the hard black Pelican case I was taking with me to Memphis today, where it had already been numerous times before. Inside were human vertebrae and bone, evidence that couldn't leave me. This stays handcuffed to me, I said, grabbing it and my briefcase. I'm really sorry to put you out like this, Marino. Are you sure it's necessary for you to come along? We had discussed this several times now, and I didn't think he should accompany me. I didn't see the point.
Like I told you, some squirrel's playing games with you, he said. Me, Wesley, Lucy, the entire friggin' bureau think I should come along. For one thing, you've made this exact same trip in every case, so it's gotten predictable. And it's been in the papers that you use this guy at UT. Parking lots were well lit and full of cars, and I couldn't help but notice people slowly driving past, looking for a place that wasn't miles from the terminal. I wondered what else Dead Doc knew about me,
and I wished I'd worn more than a trench coat. I was cold and had forgotten my gloves.
Besides, Marino added, I've never been to Graceland.
At first, I thought he was joking.
It's on my list, he went on.
What list?
The one I've had since I was a kid. Alaska, Las Vegas, and the Grand Ole Opry,
he said, as if the thought filled him with joy.
Don't you have some place you would go if you could do anything you want?
We were at the terminal now, and he held the door.
Yes, I said.
My own bed in my own home. I headed for the Delta desk, picked up our tickets, and went upstairs. Typical for this hour, nothing was open except security. When I placed my hard case on the X-ray belt, I knew what was going to happen.
Ma'am, you're going to have to open that, said the female guard.
I unlocked it and unsnapped the clasps. Inside, nestled in foam rubber, were labeled plastic bags containing the bones. The guard's eyes widened.
I've been through here before with this, I patiently explained.
She started to reach for one of the plastic bags.
Please don't touch anything, I warned.
This is evidence in a homicide.
There were several other travelers behind me now, and they were listening to every word I said.
Well, I have to look at it.
You can't.
I got out my brass medical examiner's shield and showed it to her.
You touch anything here, and I'll have to include you in the chain of evidence when this eventually goes to court. You'll be subpoenaed.
That was as much of an explanation as she needed, and she let me go.
Dumb as a bag of hammers, Marino mumbled as we walked.
She's just doing her job, I replied.
Look, he said. We don't fly back until tomorrow morning, meaning, unless you spend the whole damn day looking at bones, we should have some time.
You can go to Graceland by yourself. I've got plenty of work to do in my room. I'm also sitting in non-smoking. I chose a seat at our gate. So if you want to smoke, you'll have to go over there, I pointed. He scanned other passengers waiting, like us, to board. Then he looked at me.
You know what, Doc? He said. The problem is, you hate to have fun.
I got the morning paper out of my briefcase, shook it open. He sat next to me.
I'll bet you never even listened to Elvis.
How could I not listen to Elvis? He's on the radio, on TV, in elevators.
He's the king.
I eyed Marino over the top of the paper.
His voice. Everything about him. There's never been anyone like him.
Marino went on as if he had a crush.
I mean, it's like classical music and those painters you like so much. I think people like that only come along every couple hundred years.
So now you're comparing him with Mozart and Monet. I turned a page, bored with local politics and business.
Sometimes you're a friggin' snob.
He got up, grumpy.
And maybe just once in your life you might think of going someplace I want to go. You ever seen me bowl?
He glared down at me, getting out his cigarettes.
You ever said anything nice about my truck? You ever gone fishing with me? You ever eat at my house? No. I gotta go to yours because you live in the right part of town.
You cook for me, I'll come over, I said as I read. He angrily stalked off, and I could feel the eyes of strangers on us. I supposed they assumed that Marino and I were an item, and hadn't gotten along in years. Smiling to myself, I turned a page. Not only would I go to Graceland with him, I planned to buy him barbecue tonight. Since it seemed that one could not fly direct from Richmond to anywhere except Charlotte, we were routed to Cincinnati first, where we changed planes. We arrived in Memphis by noon and checked into the Peabody Hotel. I had gotten us a government rate of $73 per night, and Marino looked around, gawking at a grand lobby of stained glass and a fountain of mallard ducks. "Holy shit," he said. "I've never seen a joint that has live ducks. They're everywhere." We were walking into the restaurant, which was appropriately named Mallard's, and displayed behind glass were duck objets d'art. There were paintings of ducks on walls, and ducks were on the staff's green vests and ties. "They have a duck palace on the roof," I said, "and roll out a red carpet for them twice a day when they come and go to John Philip Sousa."
"No way."
I told the hostess that we would like a table for two. "In non-smoking," I added. The restaurant was crowded with men and women wearing big name tags for some real estate convention they were attending at the hotel. We sat so close to other people that I could read reports they were perusing and hear their affairs. I ordered a fresh fruit plate and coffee, while Marino got his usual grilled hamburger platter.
"Medium rare," he told the waiter.
"Medium." I gave Marino a look.
"Yeah, yeah, okay,"
he shrugged. "Enterohemorrhagic E. coli," I said to him as the waiter walked off. "Trust me, not worth it."
"Don't you ever want to do things bad for you?" he said.
He looked depressed and suddenly old, as he sat across from me in this beautiful place, where people were well-dressed and better paid than a police captain from Richmond. Marino's hair had thinned to an unruly fringe circling the top of his ears like a tarnished silver halo shoved low. He hadn't lost an ounce since I had known him, his belly rising from his belt and touching the edge of the table. Not a day went by that I didn't fear for him. I couldn't imagine his not working with me forever. At 1:30, we left the hotel in the rental car. He drove because he would never have it any other way, and we got on Madison Avenue and followed it east, away from the Mississippi River. The Brick University was so close we could have walked it, the Regional Forensic Center across the street from a tire store and the Lifeblood Donor Center. Marino parked in back, near the public entrance of the medical examiner's office. The facility was funded by the county and about the size of my central district office in Richmond. There were 3 forensic pathologists and also 2 forensic anthropologists, which was very unusual and enviable, for I would have loved to have someone like Dr. David Cantor on my staff. Memphis had yet another distinction that was decidedly not a happy one. The chief had been involved in perhaps 2 of the most infamous cases in the country. He had performed the autopsy of Martin Luther King and had witnessed the one of Elvis.
"If it's all the same to you," Marino said as we got out of the car, "I think I'll make phone calls while you do your thing."
"Fine. I'm sure they can find an office for you to use." He squinted up at an autumn blue sky, then looked around as we walked.
"I can't believe I'm here," he said. "This is where he was posted."
No, I said, because I knew exactly who he was talking about. Elvis Presley was posted at Baptist Memorial Hospital. He never came here, even though he should have.
"How come?"
"He was treated like a natural death," I replied.
"Well, he was. He died of a heart attack."
"It's true his heart was terrible," I said, "but that's not what killed him. His death was due to his poly drug abuse."
"His death was due to Colonel Parker,"
Marino muttered as if he wanted to kill the man. I glanced at him as we entered the office. Elvis had 10 drugs on board. He should have been signed out an accident. It's sad.
And we know it was really him,
he then said. Oh, for God's sake, Marino.
What? You've seen the photos? You know it for a fact,
he went on. I've seen them, and yes, I know, I said as I stopped at the receptionist's desk.
Then what's in them?
He wouldn't stop. A young woman named Shirley, who had taken care of me before, waited for Marino and me to quit disagreeing. That is none of your business, I sweetly said to him. Shirley, how are you? Back again, she smiled. With no good news, I'm sorry to say, I replied. Marino began trimming his fingernails with a pocket knife, glancing around like Elvis might walk in any minute. Dr. Cantor's expecting you, she said. Come on, I'll take you back. While Marino ambled off to make phone calls somewhere down the hall, I was shown into the modest office of a man I had known since his residency days at the University of Tennessee. Cantor had been as young as Lucy when I had met him for the first time. A devotee of forensic anthropologist Dr. Bass, who had begun the decay research facility in Knoxville known as the Body Farm, Cantor had been mentored by most of the greats. He was considered the world's foremost expert in saw marks, and I wasn't quite sure what it was about this state famous for the Vols and Daniel Boone. Tennessee seemed to corner the market on experts in time of death and human bones.
Kay,
Cantor rose, extending his hand. Dave, you're always so good to see me on such short notice. I took a chair across from his desk.
Well, I hate what you're going through.
He had dark hair combed straight back from his brow, so that whenever he looked down, it fell in his way. He was constantly shoving it out of his way, but didn't seem aware of it. His face was youthful and interestingly angular, with closely set eyes and a strong jaw and nose. "How are Jill and the kids?" I inquired.
"Great. We're expecting again."
"Congratulations. That makes 3?
4?"
His smile got bigger. "I don't know how you do it," I said sincerely.
"Doing it's the easy part. What goodies have you brought me?"
Setting the hard case on the edge of his desk, I opened it and got out the plastic-enclosed sections of bone. I handed them to him, and he took out the left femur first. He studied it under a lamp with his lens, slowly turning it end over end. He said.
"So you didn't notch the end you cut,"
he glanced at me. He wasn't chastising, just reminding, and I felt angry with myself again. Usually I was so careful. If anything, I was known for being cautious to the point of obsession. "I made an assumption, and I was wrong," I said. I didn't expect to discover that the killer used a saw with characteristics very similar to mine.
"They usually don't use autopsy saws."
He pushed back his chair and got up.
"I've never had a case, really. Just studied that type of saw mark in theory, here in the lab."
"Then that's what this is." I had suspected as much.
"I can't say with certainty until I get it under the scope. But both ends look like they've been cut with a striker saw."
He gathered the bags of bones, and I followed him out into the hall as my misgivings got worse. I didn't know what we would do if he couldn't tell the saw marks apart. A mistake like this was enough to ruin a case in court. Now, I know you're probably not going to tell much about the vertebral bone, I said, for it was trabecular, less dense than other bone and therefore not a good surface for tool marks.
Never hurts to bring it anyway. We might get lucky,
he said as we entered his lab. There wasn't an inch of empty space. 35-gallon drums of degreaser and polyurethane varnish were parked wherever they would fit. Shelves from floor to ceiling were crammed with packaged bones, and in boxes and on carts were every type of saw known to man. Dismemberments were rare, and I knew of only three obvious motivations for taking a victim apart. Transporting the body was easier. Identification was slowed, if not made impossible. Or, simply, the killer was malicious. Cantor pulled a stool close to an operating microscope equipped with a camera. He moved aside a tray of fractured ribs and thyroid cartilage that he must have been working on before I arrived.
This guy was kicked in the throat, among other things, he absently said as he pulled on surgical gloves.
Such a nice world we live in, I commented. Cantor opened the Ziploc bag containing the segment of right femur. Because he couldn't fit it on the microscope stage without cutting a section that was thin enough to mount, he had me hold the 2-inch length of bone against the table's edge. Then he bent a 25-power fiber optics light close to one of the sawn surfaces.
Definitely a striker saw, he said as he peered into the lenses. You got to have a fast-moving, reciprocating motion to create a polish like this. It almost looks like polished stone. See?
He moved aside, and I looked. The bone was slightly beveled, like water frozen in gentle ripples, and it shone. Unlike other power saws, the striker had an oscillating blade that didn't move very far. It didn't cut skin, only the hard surface it was pressed against, like bone, or a cast an orthopedist cut from a mending limb. Obviously, I said, the transverse cuts across the midshaft are mine, from removing marrow for DNA.
But the knife marks aren't. No, absolutely not. Well, we're probably not going to have much luck with them.
Knives basically covered their own tracks, unless the victim's bone or cartilage was stabbed or hacked.
But the good news is, we got a few false starts, a wider kerf and TPI, he said,
adjusting the microscope's focus as I continued holding the bone. I had known nothing about saws until I began spending so much time with Cantor. Bone is an excellent surface for tool marks, and when saw teeth cut into it, a groove or kerf is formed. By microscopically examining the walls and floor of a kerf, one can determine exit chipping on the side where the saw exited bone. Determining the characteristics of the individual teeth, the number of teeth per inch, TPI, the spacing of them and the striae can reveal the shape of the blade. Cantor angled the optic light to sharpen the striations and the defects.
You can see the curve of the blade. He pointed to several false starts on the shaft, where someone had pushed the saw blade into the bone and then tried again in another spot.
Not mine, I said. Or at least I hope I'm more adept than that.
Since this also is the end where most of the knife cuts are, I'm going to agree that it wasn't you. Whoever did this had to cut first with something else, since an oscillating blade won't cut flesh.
What about the saw blade? I asked, for I knew what I'd used in the morgue.
teeth are large, 17 per inch. So this is going to be a round autopsy blade. Let's turn it over.
I did, and he directed the light at the other end, where there were no false starts. The surface was polished and beveled like the other one, but not identical to Cantor's discerning eye.
"Power autopsy saw with the large sectioning blade," he said. "Multidirectional cut, since the radius of the blade's too small to cut through the whole bone in one stroke. So whoever did this just changed directions, going at it from different angles, with a great deal of skill. We have slight bending of the kerfs, minimal exit chipping. Again, denoting great skill with the saw. I'm going to bump up the power some and see if we can accentuate the harmonics."
He referred to the distance between saw teeth.
"Tooth distance is 0.06. 16 teeth per inch," he counted. "Direction is push-pull, tooth-type chisel. I'm voting this is yours."
"You caught me," I said with relief. "Guilty as charged."
"I would think so."
He was still looking.
"I wouldn't think you use a round blade for anything."
The large round autopsy blades were heavy and continuous rolling and destroyed more bone. Generally, this was a utility blade used in labs or in doctor's offices to saw off casts. "The rare occasion I might use a round blade is on animals," I said.
"Of the two- or four-legged variety."
"I've taken bullets out of dogs, birds, cats, and on one fine occasion a python shot in a drug raid," I replied. Cantor was looking at another bone.
"And I thought I was the one who had all the fun."
"Do you find it unusual that someone would use a meat saw in four dismemberments and then suddenly switch to an electric autopsy saw?" I asked.
"If your theory's correct about the cases in Ireland, then you're talking 9 cases with a meat saw," he said. "How about holding this right here so I can get a picture?"
I held the section of left femur in the tips of my fingers, and he pressed a button on the camera.
"To answer your question," he said, "I would find it extremely unusual. You're talking 2 different profiles. The meat saw is manual, physical, usually 10 teeth per inch. It'll go through tissue and takes a lot of bone with each stroke. The saw mark's rougher looking, more indicative of someone skilled and powerful. And it's also important to remember that in each of those earlier cases, the perpetrator cut through joints versus the shafts, which is also very rare."
"It's not the same person," I again voiced my growing belief. Cantor took the bone from my hand and looked at me.
"That's my vote."
When I returned to the lobby of the M.E.'s office, Marino was still on the phone down the hall. I waited a little while, then stepped outside because I needed air. I needed sunshine and sights that weren't savage. Some 20 minutes passed before he finally walked out and joined me by the car.
"I didn't know you was here," he said. "If someone had told me, I would have got out the phone."
"It's all right." "What a gorgeous day." He unlocked the car.
"How did it go?"
he asked, sliding into the driver's seat. I briefly summarized as we sat in the parking lot, not going anywhere.
"You want to go back to the Peabody?"
he asked, tapping the steering wheel with his thumb. I knew exactly what he wanted to do.
"No,"
I said. Graceland might be just what the doctor ordered. He shoved the car in gear and couldn't suppress a big grin. "We want the Fowler Expressway," I said, for I had studied a map. "I wish you could get me his autopsy report." He started on that again. "I want to see for myself what happened to him. Then I'll know, and it won't eat at me anymore." "What do you want to know?" I looked at him. "If it was like they said. Did he die on the toilet? That's always bothered the hell out of me. You know how many cases like that I've seen?" He glanced at me. "Don't matter if you're some drone or the President of the United States. You end up dead with a ring around your butt. Hope to hell that don't happen to me." Elvis was found on the floor of his bathroom. He was nude, and yes, it is believed that he slid off his black porcelain toilet. "Who found him?" Marina was entranced in an uneasy way. "A girlfriend who was staying in the adjoining room." "Or that's the story," I said. "You mean he walks in there, feels fine, sits down, and boom? No warning signs and nothing?" "All I know is he'd been playing racquetball in the early morning and seemed fine," I said.
"You're kidding!"
Marino's curiosity was insatiable. "Now I never heard that part. I didn't know he played racquetball." We drove through an industrialized area, with trains and trucks, then past campers for sale. Graceland stood in the midst of cheap motels and stores, and didn't seem so grand given its surroundings. The light gray stone mansion with its columns was completely out of place, like a joke or a set for a bad movie.
"Holy shit,"
Marino said as he pulled into the parking lot.
"Will you look at that? Holy smoke!"
He went on as if it were Buckingham Palace, as he parked beside a bus.
"You know, I wish I could have known him," he wistfully said.
"Maybe you would have, had he taken better care of himself." I opened my door as he lit a cigarette. For the next 2 hours, we wandered through gilt and mirrors, shag carpeting and stained glass peacocks, as the voice of Elvis followed us through his world. Hundreds of fans had arrived on buses, and their passion for this man was on their faces as they walked around listening to the tour on cassette. Many of them placed flowers, cards, and letters on his grave. Some wept as if they had known him well. We wandered around his purple and pink Cadillacs, Stutz Blackhawk, and museum of other cars. There were his planes and shooting range, and the Hall of Gold, with Grammy showcases of gold and platinum records, and trophies and other awards that amazed even me. The hall was at least 80 feet long. I couldn't take my eyes off splendid costumes of gold and sequins, and photographs of what was truly an extraordinarily and sensuously beautiful human being. Marino was blatantly gawking, an almost pained expression on his face that reminded me of puppy love as we inched our way through rooms.
"You know, they didn't want him to move here when he bought this place," he announced,
and we were outside now, the fall afternoon cool and bright.
"Some of the snobs in this city never did accept him. I think that hurt him, in a way. Might be what got him in the end. You know, why he took painkillers."
"He took more than that," I made the point again as we walked.
"If you had been a medical examiner, could you have done his autopsy?"
He got out cigarettes.
"Absolutely." "And you wouldn't have covered his face?"
He looked indignant as he fired up his lighter.
"Of course not." Not me. He shook his head, sucking in smoke. No frickin' way I'd even want to be in the room.
I wish he had been my case, I said. I wouldn't have signed him out as a natural death. The world should know the truth, so maybe somebody else would think twice about popping Percodan.
We were in front of one of the gift shops now, and people were gathered around televisions inside, watching Elvis videos. Through outdoor speakers, he was singing Kentucky Rain, his voice powerful and playful, unlike any other I had ever heard in my life. I started walking again and told the truth. I am a fan and have a rather extensive collection of his CDs, if you really must know, I said to Marino. He couldn't believe it. He was thrilled. And I'd appreciate it if you didn't spread that around.
All these years I've known you, and you never told me? He exclaimed. You're not kidding me, right? I never would have thought that. Not in a million years. Hey, so maybe now you know I've got taste.
This went on as we waited for a shuttle to return us to the parking lot, and then it continued in the car.
I remember watching him on TV once, when I was a kid in New Jersey, Marino was saying. My old man came in drunk, as usual, started yelling at me to switch the channel. I'll never forget it.
He slowed and turned into the Peabody Hotel.
Elvis was singing Hound Dog, July, 1956. I remember it was my birthday. My father comes in, cussing, turns the TV off, and I get up and turn it back on. He smacks the side of my head, turns the TV off again. I turn it back on and walk toward him. First time in my life I ever laid a hand on him. I slam him against the wall, get in his face, tell the son of a bitch if he ever touches me or my mother again, I'm gonna kill him.
And did he? I asked as the valet opened my door.
Shit, no.
Then Elvis should be thanked, I said. Chapter 7 2 days later, on Thursday, November 6th, I started out early on the 90-minute drive from Richmond to the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia. Marino and I took separate cars, since we never knew when something might happen to send us off somewhere. For me, it could be a plane crash or derailed train, while he had to deal with city government and layers of brass. I wasn't surprised when my car phone rang as we neared Fredericksburg. The sun was in and out of clouds, and it felt cold enough to snow.
Scarpetta, I said on speakerphone.
Marino's voice erupted inside my car.
City Council's freaking, he said. You got McEwen, whose little kid's been hit by a car. Now more crap about our case. On TV, in the papers, hear it on the radio.
More leaks had occurred over the past 2 days. Police had a suspect in serial murders that included 5 cases in Dublin. An arrest was imminent.
You believe this shit? Marino exclaimed. We're talking about what? Someone in his mid-20s, and somehow he was in Dublin over the past few years? Bottom line is, council suddenly decided to have some public forum about this situation. Probably because they think it's about to be resolved. Gotta get that credit, right? Make the citizens think maybe they did something for once.
He was careful what he said, but seething.
So, I gotta turn my ass right back around and be at City Hall by 10. Plus, the chief wants to see me.
I watched his taillights up ahead as he approached an exit. I-95 was busy this morning with trucks and people who commuted every day to D.C. No matter how early I started, whenever I headed north, it seemed traffic was terrible.
Actually, it's a good thing you're going to be there. Cover my back, too, I said to him. I'll get up with you later, let you know what went on.
Yo, when you see Ring, do that to his neck, he said.
I arrived at the academy, and the guard in his booth waved me through, because by now he knew my car and its license plate. The parking lot was so full, I ended up almost in the woods. Firearms training was already in progress on ranges across the road, and drug enforcement agents were out in camouflage, gripping assault rifles, their faces mean. The grass was heavy with dew, and soaked my shoes as I took a shortcut to the main entrance of the tan brick building called Jefferson. Inside the lobby, luggage was parked near couches and the walls, for there were always National Academy, or N.A. police, going somewhere, it seemed. The video display over the front desk reminded everyone to have a nice day and properly display his badge. Mine was still in my purse, and I got it out, looping the long chain around my neck. Inserting a magnetized card into a slot, I unlocked a glass door etched with the Department of Justice seal and followed a long glass-enclosed corridor. I was deep in thought and scarcely cognizant of new agents in dark blue and khaki and N.A. students in green. They nodded and smiled as they passed, and I was friendly too, but I didn't focus. I was thinking of the torso, of her infirmities and age, of her pitiful pouch in the freezer, where she would stay for several years or until we knew her name. I thought of Keith Pleasance, of Dead Doc, of saws and sharp blades. I smelled hops solvent as I turned into the gun cleaning room with its rows of black counters and compressors blasting air through the innards of guns. I could never smell these smells or hear these sounds without thinking of Wesley and of Mark. My heart was squeezed by feelings too strong for me when a familiar voice called out my name.
"Looks like we're heading the same way," said Investigator Ring.
Impeccably dressed in navy blue, he was waiting for the elevator that would take us 60 feet below ground, where Hoover had built his bomb shelter. I switched my heavy briefcase to my other hand and tucked the box of slides more snugly under my arm.
"Good morning," I blandly said.
"Here, let me help with some of that."
He held out a hand as the elevator doors parted, and I noticed his nails were buffed.
"I'm fine," I said, because I didn't need his help.
We boarded, both of us staring straight ahead as we began the ride down to a windowless level of the building directly beneath the indoor firing range. Ring had sat in on consultations before, and he took copious notes, none of which had ended up in the news thus far. He was too clever for that. Certainly, if information divulged during an FBI consultation was leaked, it would be easy enough to trace. There were only a few of us who could be the source. I was rather dismayed by the information the press somehow got access to, I said as we got out.
"I know what you mean," Ring said with a sincere face.
He held open the door leading into a labyrinth of hallways that comprised what once had begun as behavioral science, then changed to investigative support, and now was Caskew. Names changed, but the cases didn't. Men and women often came to work in the dark and left after it was dark again, spending days and years studying the minutiae of monsters, their every tooth mark and track in mud, the way they think and smell and hate.
"The more information that gets out, the worse it is,"
Ring went on as we approached another door, leading into a conference room where I spent at least several days a month.
It's one thing to give details that might help the public help us.
He talked on, but I wasn't listening. Inside, Wesley was already sitting at the head of a polished table, his reading glasses on. He was going through large photographs stamped on the back with the name of the Sussex County Sheriff's Department. Detective Grigg was several chairs away. A lot of paperwork in front of him as he studied a sketch of some sort. Across from him was Frankel from the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, or VICAP. And at the other end of the table, my niece. She was tapping on a laptop computer and glanced up at me, but didn't say hello. I took my usual chair to the right of Wesley, opened my briefcase, and began arranging files. Ring sat on the other side of me and continued our conversation.
We got to accept as a fact that this guy is following everything in the news, he said. That's part of the fun for him.
He had everyone's attention, all eyes on him, the room silent except for his own sound. He was reasonable and quiet, as if his only mission was to convey the truth, without drawing undue attention to himself. Ring was a superb con man, and what he said next in front of my colleagues incensed me beyond belief.
For example, and I have to be honest about this, he said to me, I just don't think it was a good idea to give out the race, age, and all about the victim. Now maybe I'm wrong, he looked around the room, but it seems like the less said, the better right now.
I had no choice, I said, and I couldn't keep the edge out of my voice. Since someone had already leaked misinformation.
But that's always going to happen, and I don't think it should force us to give out details before we're ready, he said in his same earnest tone.
It's not going to help us if the public is focused on a missing prepubescent Asian female. I stared at him, eye to eye, while everyone else looked on.
I agree, Frankel from VICAP spoke. We'd be getting missing person files from all over the country. An error like that.